Accession number 10167, Reel 1.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Elliott?
19th of February 1923, in South Shields. And so I'm technically a Geordie.
What sort of background do you come from? What did your father do?
My father was a coal miner, and we lived in a coal mining area in South Shields. And it was a pretty hard childhood, I guess. But my parents were very keen to given me a good education, and I passed to the grammar school, and I went to the high school at South Shields, and I passed what was the school certificate in those days at about, I think, the end of the, sorry, the beginning of the war, 1939.
So you'd had a much better education than most of your contemporaries.
Oh, yeah. Well, few people really would have gone to the grammar school in that area. They were sort of secondary schools and primary schools otherwise.
Were you involved in any of the sort of boys' clubs or organisations such as Church Lads Brigade or Scouts or anything like that?
No, not that I recall to any great degree.
Now, you, while you were at school, did you sit, were you interested in politics or international politics? Were you aware of the possibility of war as you came up?
Yes. I was thinking about that recently. I think there was a greater awareness among some people than others. But it has struck me recently, because it arose in another connection, the degree to which people were aware of fascism in 1939. And although this is debatable, my feeling would be that most of the ordinary general public weren't aware of the totality of fascism as we know it now. That more or less came out during and after the war. What people were reacting to were just territorial aggression of Hitler and Mussolini. Sort of view that Hitler was wrapping up one country after another in Europe. And that if he wasn't stopped, of course, it would be our turn next.
And that was the sort of perspective you had at the time?
Well, the other side of the coin was that my father was very political. He eventually became a councillor in South Shields. So, and he was a socialist. And, of course, I had all this background of being brought up as a socialist. He had been in the First World War and was a pacifist, really, somewhat naturally.
Had you been influenced then by the Spanish Civil War?
Yes, because people saw that as a preliminary battle between fascism and communism. And it would be in the nature of the background that we would be on the communist side, as it were. Communism didn't have that sort of connotations that it has nowadays. I think the acceptance of communism as akin to socialism and therefore to be supported lasted throughout the war because we were allies, and it was only after the war that really it began to turn around somewhat. But the Spanish Civil War then was seen to be as a conflict in embryo between fascism and the forces of democracy, in effect.
Now, you were in your last year at school in 1939, did you think, when war was declared, did you think it would involve you? How did you feel? Do you remember the day war was declared?
Yes. It was a Sunday, as I remember. Beautifully sunny day, and the announcement was made on the radio. And people thought something was going to happen immediately. So there were aircraft noises in the sky, so people went out and looked around. And there was this feeling of anticlimax. I think everyone more or less was anticipating the need to go to war. I think the business with Chamberlain, everyone felt that was a national disgrace, and although no one wanted to fight especially, they thought it was about the time that we had to do something about it. Therefore, when the war came, it was more or less accepted by everybody as a necessity, although there were some conscientious objectors, but the great majority of people thought it was about time.
Did you think it would involve you? You were at a...
Everyone wanted to volunteer. I think that was really somewhat significant.
Did that include you?
Yes, yes. All the young people, without exception, saw the need for it and thought that it was necessary that they should volunteer and get into the war as soon as they could.
What was it exactly that made you want to volunteer?
I think there's this feeling that we were dealing with something quite foreign and hostile and anti-democratic, and therefore had to be stopped. But it was also on the level of, if we didn't do something, then of course the Germans would be coming over to attack us. And we were really, in the end, just defending our homeland, basically.
Did you take any actual action to try and volunteer at that time? You'd be underage still.
Yes. There was nothing that one could do, actually. But I did join various things, which I'll come to in a moment. But everyone generally wanted to go into the RAF. This was the sort of glamour thing. So as soon as I think probably one could do that sort of 17 over, and I did try to get in the RAF at one stage. But later on, I joined the Home Guard, and I was in the civil defence, in the control section. But before that, I think the real problem in the beginning was, what should I do with my life? Because I don't honestly know whether there would be any question of my going to university. I'm sure the family would have wanted me. It would have depended upon really the financial situation. But the thing was, with the war was clearly imminent for some time beforehand, so I mean, everyone really didn't feel that they had much of a future at all to look forward to in that respect, outside of any conflict. So it only became a question of, what should I do? And it was the opportunity of joining in something and finding a job and earning some money.
What eventually did you get?
Well, there were sort of two stages. I dropped a clanger in the beginning, because I wasn't clear what I should do. I thought that, I don't know where it came from, may have come from my father. He was of the opinion that if one trained to be an apprentice, say an electrician, that would be a good job with some prospects. So I did apply to become an apprentice electrician at a naval yard, shipbuilding yard at the time. And, you know, I had a good school certificate at that stage. And I was accepted. And I had this spell as an electrician. But it really wasn't. I wasn't cut out to be. I wasn't all that terribly handy with my hands. And I found that the journey was horrific. I had to get up very early in the morning and go by bus and across the ferry up the Tyne and come back again. It was an awfully long day.
Which yard were you in?
I think it was the Vickers Armstrong Yard at Elswick. And they were building a warship there. But which one it is, I can't remember. But there was one warship that I had some part in fitting the electric cables to. Whether it was ever very successful, I do not know. And the other thing was, of course, I had lived in a tough area. But as an apprentice in a shipyard, one was subject to quite a different sort of environment, and it was very, very basic. and the language was foul. And I didn't really care for it at all.
Were you actively bullied, or was it just the general call?
It's the general pushing around and pissing about that apprentices get. You get sent off on all sorts of stupid errands. You know. it's a hard life, particularly in those days. And the apprentices are right at the bottom of the ladder, and they tend to get all of the wit and the butts of jokes and things.
What did you actually have to do? Do you remember in this wiring of the ship?
I had just to help the electrician, and he was putting in cables along the bulkheads of the boat. They were finishing it off, and we were putting up these lengths of cabling along in and through the ship. It was a massive, and there were tremendous number of people working there.
Is it during this time you joined the Home Guard and the Civil Defence, or was that later?
Probably sure afterwards, when I left.
So where did you go to? You left?
There were these jobs for temporary clerks in the town hall at South Shields. So I applied for that, and I must say I probably got some help because my father knew councillors. Whether or not it was holy, that I don't know, but I was quite grateful for the opportunity to get out. And I finished up in the Borough Treasurer's Department as a junior temporary clerk.
So that was just bookkeeping and general office work?
Well, you know, the beginning of accountancy work, really, bookkeeping in those days. It really was quite Dickensian in a way. It was at the stage where people had these tall, sloping desks and used pens and ink and huge ledgers. Ledgers about a yard wide, all in handwritten. Some of them were absolutely marvellous when you come to look at it nowadays. In pound shillings and pence, pages upon pages, which every year had to be added up. We did have comptometers, but they were added by individuals manually and then checked by comptometers. And then every year when we had to do the final accounts, you had to balance to the halfpenny. And we used to spend hours towards the end of the year balancing these books and burn the midnight oil if the things didn't balance.
But this work appealed to you much more?
Yes, that was much more the sort of job that I was really more cut out to do.
Now, this is what you did until you were called up in September 42.
Yeah.
So it must have been during this period you joined the Home Guard.
Yes.
Could you tell me about how you came to do that then, the joining of the Home Guard?
Well, there was this impelling urgency to do something, and there was a fair bit of pressure. You know, everyone was of the opinion in these early days of the war that you should be involved in it somehow or other, and you felt under some obligation to be doing your bit. It wasn't just enough to have a job; you should be doing something else. Participate in the war effort. So I joined the Home Guard, and it was rather like Dad's army. I was a sort of a young lad in that situation. And we were in an anti-aircraft rocket squadron.
Do you know the name of the branch of the Home Guard you were in, or the unit of the Home Guard?
No, that's too
just
far
based
away.
On South Shields.
We had a site which is off Highfield Drive in South Shields on the top of the cliffs, and there were two fields there, and they had this pattern of anti-aircraft rocket launchers, and they were in a sort of a square with so many at intervals so that you had a grid, and there were two of them. And what the aim was to fire all of these rockets into the air, into this grid formation, to catch any aircraft that were coming in over the sea. And they fired immense rockets, about 5 or 6 feet long, which you loaded onto racks at each side. It spun round, did the whole contraption. The operator was in the middle, and he had a rocket on each side of him. You set the fuse, which determined how high the rocket went before it actually exploded, and you turned the whole of the machine round to give you the direction, and you set an elevation. And these were all given to you by some control. And they were tuned in to local anti-aircraft defences and sent you the information, and everybody set their fuses and the elevation and the direction, and then at a given signal it was sent off all these rockets up into the air. And I think we shot down one aircraft once upon a time. So it was part of the anti-aircraft protection, rather like balloons. They also had balloons, and this was part of the same sort of defensive program.
What sort of a rotor were your duties on with this?
It would be manned all the time, and I think we only did about 2 or 3 nights a week, as far as I remember.
Your unit, so it was shared with
other people? It was shared with other people, yes. I mean, it went in with being on full-time. I mean, this was only a part-time thing, so it was in the...
So how many hours would you... When you were on a stint of duty, how many hours would you be on, roughly?
Oh, my God.
Was it overnight, or...?
It would be overnight, yes, I think.
But you'd be expected to go to work this morning?
Yes, probably about 6 or 7 hours, I would think. Because it wasn't far, I used to walk back home.
What was your job in the actual firing of these things?
I was part of the team. You used to have two men on the team, and one of them used to load up and the other one used to set, and then you both jump in, because you had to sort of protect yourself from the blast. So you jumped in the central portion of this sort of device, and then... Somebody pressed the button. So I was either a loader or a firer. One took turns with this sort of thing.
Did you get any other military training with the Home Guard, or was this purely just to...
Oh, yeah, we did sort of basic drills and things. We had uniform and so forth. And I was a fool. I was quite naive, actually. I remember coming back home to my parents and saying that I was going to have an FFI exam in the morning, and everyone thought that was great. How interesting that was. And I hadn't realised the FFI inspection meant dropping your trousers and somebody examining your balls and things to see if you had any livestock on you. No, I hadn't realised that because, as I say, I was so new to that sort of thing. Also at the same time, and this arose from my town hall duties, they used to have people who were in a control section in case of... bomb attacks upon the town, and these were people who manned the control section and planned the civil defence response to it, and we used to map where the bombs had dropped, and they also had representatives from the police and the fire brigade and water and all the utilities, and this was the core of the civilian response to any sort of enemy action.
And what would you do within the control section yourself?
I used to plot any activities onto maps and things, or act as a messenger, sort of thing we did. And that was an all-night operation. But unless there was actually air attacks, we usually went to sleep in the town hall overnight.
Right. Would the next you were called up in September 1942, as I said. You tried to volunteer for the RAF early. When did you actually try and do that? Because you failed an eyesight grant,
yes,
didn't you? When did you actually do that?
I've got the date somewhere. My guess would be early in 42, might even mean 41. After that, my not getting into the RAF, I lost interest in, you know, I thought after that I'd be bound to go into the army, so I wasn't going to break my neck to go into the army at that stage.
What was the attraction of the RAF for you?
It was the glamour, and everyone thought it would be great up in the air, flying aircraft and this sort of thing, and everyone wanted to be in the RAF. And most of my contemporaries from school, you know, did go into the RAF. So it was somewhat natural, I think.
Were you upset when you failed the eyesight?
Yes. So, you know, as I say, that would probably have been the acme of my ambition at that moment in time.
Were you influenced at all by your father's experiences? Because he'd been in the infantry in the First World War.
Yes, yes. When I was very young, you do the old man a disservice. I remember there was very little other sort of entertainment, so they used to go around and chat over their wartime experiences with, you know, their friends. And I was taken along, and, you know, I used to get these experiences. Some, almost all of them, I've totally forgotten now. Because I wasn't really taking that much interest in it. Got to the point where, as I say, I did the old man a disservice, because after a while I realized that he wasn't actually telling the whole story, or that the story changed, or that his part in it changed. You know, I got that acumen that the old man was glamorizing it, really, although he was basically a pacifist and had seen the absolute atrocities and the desolation of the First World War, where there was a lot more death in sort of static conditions. At the same time, it was something that had been quite an experience to him, and I feel that myself. I now appreciate him more, that aspect of his life, more than I did at the time. After a while, I began to feel that he was exaggerating, that he was glamorizing it to a degree, and demeaned him rather, unfortunately. I sort of felt, well, you know, he wasn't actually saying it as it probably was, that he tended to sort of take a very rosy view of it, although basically the experience had saddened him and attached to his whole political life afterwards that dimension that he was very much against the sort of thing. At the same time, it had been something that he, at the end of it, would have been quite happy to have had the experience for.
Could you tell me what exactly happened when you were called up and how you and your family reacted?
Well, when it did come, of course, I really wasn't all that keen to go. By that time, I was occupying quite an important role. Most of the older members of the office had gone to war. And I was doing more and more responsible work at that time, and I was occupying quite, you know, an influential position. There weren't many of us left. I was very interested in what I was doing, and I found, you know, that I had a flair for it. So that when the summons actually came, I wasn't at all happy about it. And I felt then that it was taking me away from something that I would much rather have stayed with, although I accepted that I had to go. That there
you
wasn't.
Didn't try and get out of it then?
Oh, no. There's no way that one could, actually.
Were you told to report?
I had to report to Preston. And although I don't know the actual number of the unit I went to, it was at Fulwood Barracks at Preston. I know that much because I've got a photograph there. And it would be an initial basic training battalion, and it was a Royal Engineers battalion. That was something else that was odd, because they were all sappers. And it was most surprising, because they were training just ordinary infantry people. I suppose it was just the way that it all fell out. But they happened to be sappers, and they had this sort of different nomenclature. Their privates were sappers, and they had bombardiers and lance bombardiers and that sort of thing. And that was our first experience of going to the army, learning totally different titles to what we would be knowing the similar positions later on in life.
just take the bits of being the training period in turn. What were the conditions of service like at Preston, and how did you react to them? I'm thinking of the accommodation, the food, and the lack of privacy of army life, and how these impinged on you at the time.
Well, you were accommodated in huts, huge huts, with stoves, sort of pot-bellied stoves in them, which you had to keep clean and everything. On hard wooden beds with blankets and mattresses of some sort or other, I would guess. Possibly 10 to 20, I'm not quite sure. Something between 10 and 20 people per hut. Probably more, because we had a Lance Bombardier in charge of us who gave us hell. I mean, this is the sort of thing. We thought he was God. Well, we had to treat him as God. That was, you know, what he said went, and you did whatever he said. And he was only a Lance Bombardier, a Lance Corporal, in effect. And so perhaps there'd be something like 20 in there.
You say treat, you know, he made life hell for you.
Yeah.
How? What was he doing that was so bad?
Well, it was part, I suppose, of a natural process that one has in the army, that the basic training experience is to totally change your attitudes to civilian ways of doing things, that they had to break any independent spirit that you had. You were trained to obey absolutely any orders that you were given, without question. So that was their main preoccupation. You had to go into what was essentially just an almost a feeling of being an automaton. You were trying to be molded into a fighting machine to sort of kill people by various methods, I guess. And also that you had to keep all your equipment clean and in good order and preserved, and you lost nothing. So that was another heinous crime. And that everything had to be cleaned and polished, what's known as bullshit in those days. And you come back to that later on. You see this pattern coming through life. Later on, when you get into sort of war service situations, bull doesn't exist. But as soon as you pulled out again, it would come back again. And we all say, oh, we're back to the bull again, people are polishing things and this sort of thing. It was all part of the army experience, the army way to do it. This was something that they'd got themselves into, a way of doing things over the years, how to break people's spirit, get them to obey orders, get them to the best of their individual abilities to kill people in various ways, and to keep everything clean and in good order, and to look after you. The worst crime of all was to lose anything at all, and certainly something like a weapon. You would have been court-martialed if you'd lost a weapon in any way.
Now, you'd had a position of some responsibility with the in the Borough Treasurer's Office or South Shields. How did you respond to this effort to break you, to make you the lowest of the low, so to speak?
Well, you found it very hard at first, of course, naturally. Didn't take kindly to it. And after you'd been subjected to it for a while, then just later on you just went along with it as being the easiest way out. I mean, one appreciated that. This you hoped. I think we were conscious of the fact that it was a finite thing, that, all right, for 5 weeks, say, life would be like this, and we're looking beyond that and say, oh, well, you know, it'll be rather easier after that. And I guess it was, to some degree.
Did you kick
But it was a totally different experience, and one had to become used to that.
Did you kick against it? I mean, did you actually try
to
defy it?
No, I went along with it. You know, I don't think I was that keen. I was essentially a timid soul, I think. I went along with it. I didn't.